This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The IBM Center has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, who brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. What can our nation do to better compete in today's global economy? How can creating a strategic approach to federal budget decisions enhance national competitiveness? And what are the practical steps required to move toward a more strategic way of budgeting? Today, we'll explore these questions and so much more with Steve Redburn, study director at the National Academy of Science and contributor to Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. Steve, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
America can't address its economic prospects without a clear understanding of what it means to be competitive. Given your piece for this new book, Governing to Win, what is national competitiveness? Can you give us a sense in your mind, what exactly does that mean?
Okay. I'm not going to give you a formal economist definition of that because I'm not an economist. I'm a political scientist. But in my mind, the key to our competitiveness is building on our comparative advantages. We have great strengths relative to other countries that allow us to produce things that people want to buy, services and goods that people want to buy around the world. And we also have major liabilities that we have to manage going forward if we're going to remain competitive. But I want to emphasize that we start this competition, if you like, or we are in this competition with tremendous assets, not least of all our governing system. Our governance is world class. By most standards, by international standards, we have a clean government. We have an analytically sophisticated government that operates relatively efficiently. We have decentralized a lot of decision-making to states and local governments, which allow us to manage very complicated problems better than we could if we had a more centralized system. So I just want to start with that. And then there are a lot of other assets. We have this huge domestic economy, which allows us to pilot and try new approaches. We're a very innovative society, a very entrepreneurial society still. We have graduate schools that are the envy of the world, and you know, hundreds of them, really. So we have these tremendous world-class assets on which to build. The key is to build on those to address our weaknesses going forward so we can increase the rate of productivity and increase the rate of growth going forward, because that's the key to addressing our liabilities.
Well, that's nice. It sets a good context around your piece for the book, which is titled Creating a Strategic Approach to Budget Decisions. And I'd like to turn to that particularly. At the core, as you point out in your piece, of any well-functioning government is a budget process that policymakers can use to make big decisions about resources in a rational manner. Would you describe for us, to the extent you can, the U.S. budget process?
Well, first of all, there are two features of our process that are structural and constitutional that really we can't do much about. One is that we have divided responsibility between two branches of government, the president and Congress, who have to share power and agree on policies before they're legislated, and the budget is all done by legislation at the federal level. And then we also have a system of federal division between states and the federal government. So we have 50 autonomous states making their own budget decisions, are sovereign, have their own sources of revenue. And even in other federal systems, there's more centralization and coordination of fiscal choices at the national level than there is in this country. So those are two enduring structural features that we're not going to change anytime soon. But the best way to describe the current process is really with a metaphor. If you've seen these slow motion replays of major car wrecks in a NASCAR race where all the pieces are flying apart and people are bouncing off one another and so on, that's really what has happened to the relatively orderly process that we've had since 1974 in both the Congress and the executive, but especially in Congress. The process has fragmented, flown apart. In the best of times, it was weak at the center, stovepiped, fragmented among committees, and so on. But recently, it has just stopped working. And so we've lurched from crisis to crisis. Appropriations have not been made on time. A lot of uncertainty for everyone because of the breakdown of that process at a bad time.
And you mentioned in your piece that the process has collapsed, I think was the word. What are some of the key factors that have contributed to the situation?
Well, one thing that put the system under great stress in the recent past is the financial crisis and other emergencies on top of that, decisions to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, decisions that were largely made on an emergency basis outside the ordinary process. So because the process was working sluggishly, not on time, those decisions couldn't be made through the ordinary process. And also we have made a choice to put a lot of programs, so-called mandatory programs, on autopilot and not to revisit them on a regular or annual basis. So at this point, only about 40% of the federal spending is appropriated annually. Authority expires each year and has to be renewed. So more and more the government is spending, and also tax policy in its entirety, is on autopilot. It's not revisited automatically every year. So we're fragmented in time as well as across jurisdictions.
Well, you point out in your piece for the book that cutting costs without a strategic approach or raising taxes without tax reform could risk a period of slow growth and austerity that could cripple all efforts and threaten our position in the world. Would you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, the simplest thing to do when you have to cut back in the short run because you're running huge deficits is to sort of cut across the board. It's intellectually easier, and politically it's a shortcut. Even in the short run, it does a lot of damage. Things change from year to year. You know, war ends, we have new challenges, a pandemic next year or a major natural disaster or something else looms up, or a new opportunity to invest in new technology, for example. So priorities change quite a bit from year to year. And when the government can't complete, when the congressional process breaks down and government can't complete appropriations or can't complete them on time at the start of the fiscal year in October, then there's a lot of hidden damage that's done across agencies having to essentially live with the terms and conditions and amounts that they lived with the year before, even though there's been a lot of change. And if you, on top of that, then are ratcheting down everybody, you have additional disconnects and inefficiencies that arise. That's the short term. But in the long term, if you're not more strategic and targeted in the way you invest your resources, if you just let things drift along and move incrementally and adjust at the margins, over time, government's critical contribution to the success of the economy and its growth weakens. And that's what's been happening on both the spending side and the tax side. Mm-hmm. Tax policy is a result of a lot of individual narrow choices that favor one use of capital or income over another. No one has, since 1986, revisited the whole income tax system. So a number of small changes in the tax code have accumulated to mean that there are over $1 trillion of tax expenditures or gaps in the tax structure that function much like spending, but are not treated like spending in the appropriations process and are never looked at. And many of them probably are not optimal use of our resources. So they're simultaneously reductions in taxes and increases in subsidies for particular sectors of the economy, such as the mortgage interest deduction for home ownership, that are potentially counterproductive. In fact, in that case, did great damage to people's savings and net worth over the last 3 or 4 years.
So with that, the current state as you described it, it does present an opportunity for reform. It's an opening for reform. And I want to switch gears to talk about to what extent does this kind of situation that you describe lead to an opportunity to reform it?
Well, that's a good question. Now, we have tried to solve this problem of the weaknesses in the current budget process by ad hoc measures, such as the negotiations behind closed doors around the debt limit increase, which resulted in the Budget Control Act and the creation of a super committee, bipartisan of the House and the Senate, to try to, again, behind closed doors, come up with a grand bargain, a big package of savings that would help put the budget back on track, that is, would over the long term close the gap between revenues that are now projected and our commitments, which are outrunning our expected revenues. That process failed. It broke down. So that does create a question, at least, if not an opportunity. You know, is there a need to go back and look at the regular process and see if we can make it function? I think I would say yes, because even if there is a grand bargain, either on this side of the fiscal cliff that's coming after the election or on the other side, something like that that involves so much pain and difficult choices is going to have to be sustained through the regular budget process ultimately. And the regular budget process allows for public debate. It's more out in the open. And we need that kind of public debate to legitimize and sustain any agreements that are reached at a leadership level between parties and between the executive and the legislative branch.
I'd like to get your insights on how a properly functioning budget process would help stabilize and in fact, reduce potentially the federal government's debt.
Okay. The context here is that, as I said, we have a long-term debt problem, which we have to wrestle with. It's again, another metaphor is that the fiscal problems of the federal government were a big ship. It's headed toward the rocks, and it takes a long time to turn a big ship. And the closer we get to the rocks, the sharper the turn has to be, and the more likely that we'll have something occur that will push us back into a recession. And as I said, the fiscal cliff that's coming at the end of the year, which I think people understand now means, if nothing is done, automatic increases in taxes, ending the payroll tax cut that has been in place for 2 years, a new decision on the debt limit, and a variety of other policy changes that will occur automatically, including a sequester, which would be an across-the-board cut in discretionary spending, both defense and non-defense, would, according to the CBO's report this week, would put us back into recession and greatly complicate our problem. So we've got to come to grips with that. And as I said, we've tried the ad hoc behind-closed-door approach, so we really need to get back to thinking about how to reform and make work the regular process. And ultimately, when we make these big choices, we have to do it in a way that's strategic.
Yeah, and actually, you know, picking up on thinking about it and having folks think about it, you reference in your piece for Governing to Win the Peterson-Pugh Commission on Budget Reform. Would you tell us more about this effort and highlight some of the recommendations it offered?
Sure. That commission, which is housed with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation, is the project is ended now, but it was made up of former budget directors, both the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, the President's Budget Office, and the Congressional Budget Office, and heads of budget committees and senior budget committee staff on the Hill. In other words, old hands, people who have collectively hundreds of years of experience with the current process. So they were a very practical group, and they approached this problem in a practical way, and they looked at the structure that was created in 1974, which is not working very well now, but they said what needs to be done to make it work and what needs to be done to make it capable of addressing the long-term challenges that we face. The core of their approach was to take the current requirements and add to them a requirement that we set a target to stabilize the debt in the medium term, maybe 8-10 years out, which would require turning the big ship, and then estimate each year the budget savings over that period of time that would be required cumulatively in order to, and annually to achieve that, and then to require the Congress through its regular procedures to hit those annual and multi-year targets, and to do so with stronger centralized authority in the budget committees. In 1974, when this structure was created, there was a big fight with the appropriators. Appropriators weakened the center, weaken the budget committees. But for this approach to work, they really need to be instruments of the leadership in both the House and the Senate. And the appropriators perhaps should have people sitting on the maybe their chairs should be sitting on the budget committee so that they become the organizing instrument for the leadership to have a rational process of setting priorities and moving money where it can be used more effectively. So that's really the core of what they tried to do. They also added, they also paid a lot of attention to the need to add transparency to the process and to recognize costs as they accrue, to recognize many costs that are actually going to hit the budget but are not now looked at in real time or are not even on the budget, such as the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for example, were not part of the budget, and yet they obviously had huge budget consequences when they failed.
Well, beyond those reforms, or maybe in a complement to those reforms, you point out that the U.S. needs an approach that is more strategic in its scope and capacity to prioritize the use of resources. What would that new rigorous review process look like? Could you give us a sense?
Sure. Well, in broad terms, it's going to require three things. It's going to require a new information about benefits and performance especially, and also a new alignment of information on benefits, what we get for our money, the results that we expect, with cost information. Right now, the structure of the budget doesn't align what we're trying to achieve with the way the accounting keeps track of the amounts and appropriates the amounts. So we need to restructure the information that goes into the process. I mean, we need new decision methods. Paul Posner, who is at George Mason University and a budget expert, and I call the approach that's needed a portfolio budgeting approach, where we say, here's a major goal of the enduring mission and, or major short-term, medium-term goal that we're trying to achieve, better childhood readiness for school or better, you know, some aspect of health or whatever it is we consider a high-priority national objective. And then we look at all of the efforts that are underway and available for the federal government to achieve that goal and treat that as a portfolio of spending, of tax expenditures, also regulations, which are alternatives to spending and are often ways of leveraging changes in people's personal behavior, for example, that don't require direct spending. Look at the costs and benefits of all of the alternatives, taking that package as a set, and see if we can separate the wheat from the chaff and use that pool of resources more productively to drive progress toward that goal, whatever it is, and at the same time achieve budget savings. So that's an example of how we would reorganize the decision process. And then we need new executive and congressional budget procedures to support that more strategic approach. But the essence of it is setting clear, high-priority goals and then organizing information to and analyzing it to decide how to use our resources more effectively to drive toward those goals. At the same time, eliminating spending and tax expenditures that are not productive or relatively unproductive.
How can creating a strategic approach to federal budget decisions enhance national competitiveness? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com.
How can the federal government's purchasing and supply chains be transformed? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores this question and much more with Raj Sharma, contributor to the new IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. My guest today is Steve Redburn, author of Creating a Strategic Approach to Budget Decisions, and a contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. Steve, you laid out what a strategic budget process would look like at a high level. What are some of the benefits of applying a portfolio approach to?
If we're going to stabilize the debt and we're going to align revenues and spending over a long horizon so that we have a sustainable fiscal path, if we're going to do that, having run the numbers many times on this, we can't do it arithmetically unless we have solid economic growth over a long period of time. So we have to have a faster rate of growth. And to do that, we have to have higher productivity throughout the economy. And we need to look at the federal government's contribution to that productivity. One of the keys that McKinsey & Company identified in a recent analysis to higher productivity in the whole economy is increasing the productivity of federal spending and tax expenditures, and also reforming the tax code so it's a much more efficient collector of revenue. So we really need to use the federal budget process strategically to raise public sector productivity if we're going to have the rate of growth necessary to stabilize the fiscal outlook long term. And that's why we need a strategic approach. We can't just cut incrementally or across the board.
Well, that actually leads into another interesting point you make in your piece for the book Governing to Win. It's with the budget, you need to have a broader conception of what the budget does and is. Could you elaborate on that, maybe offer some examples of strategic budgetary analysis?
All right. In the 1980s, the late Herb Stein, who was a brilliant economist, said that before we budget for the federal government, we need to budget for the whole economy. So we need to take a broader view. In that sense, we need to start with how we're using all of society's resources and then look, secondly, at the federal government's special contribution to that and its comparative advantage relative to private investment, relative to its federal partners, which are the states, localities, and many private nonprofit groups doing wonderful things as well. So just to take an example of that broader view, when we started a study a few years ago of coastal wetlands, which are very sensitive environmental areas like salt marshes, Chesapeake Bay, places where fish migrate along the coast and so on, critical resource for the one of the many sort of second, third level goals, but still critically important that the federal government pursues is improving conditions in those environmentally sensitive coastal areas. When we started looking at that and arraying all of the different tools that are used and groups that are in organizations that are involved, we see that like a lot of other, virtually every other major goal that the government pursues over time, there are really dozens of programs scattered across multiple agencies in the federal government that have to work together under law in order to achieve progress in that area. And there are also important state, local, private partners that have to participate in that and often do and cooperate in order to achieve progress. So in that case, for example, NOAA had several programs to monitor and clean up coastal wetlands. The Army Corps of Engineers is constantly in the coastal areas, sometimes not necessarily with the same objectives, doing damage to coastal areas, but also contributing to their improvement. And NOAA is required by law to review their projects before they go forward. And then the EPA has an important role to play and so on. So you can go on and on. So that's just a single example of one goal and how there's a whole portfolio of programs just on this in the federal government, but also with other actors and partners that have to work together effectively to make progress toward that goal. So that's an example of the broader approach I was talking about.
Well, to what extent does the strategic budgeting approach that you laid out in your piece for Governing to Win recognize the complementary roles of state and local governments and other federal partners? I think you alluded to it with that example. Could you expand on it?
Right now, there is no formal mechanism for coordinating decisions between levels of government, which I think makes the U.S. almost unique even among federal systems of government in a budgetary context. So. And yet we have models for cooperation between levels of government. The Recovery Act is a good example of the implementation of that act involved close consultations in real time at the front end, especially between the small group in the White House who was managing that process and the state and local people about definitions, about reporting requirements, about how the whole allocation process was going to work and be monitored, and it produced very good results. That's an extraordinary example, I think, of spending a lot of money fast without major scandals occurring, and in a way that resulted in a lot of activity all over the country that helped stabilize the economy in a very short period of time. So it's quite a remarkable success of government working together at different levels.
So considering where we are, and you've made a comment about the nature of our governing system and politics, the federal system, how do we get from where we are in the budget process to that more strategic approach you speak of?
Well, I think as we approach, we hope, a grand bargain about policy changes that are needed to stabilize the debt, I hope that as part of that negotiation that we consider fixing the federal budget process. I mean, it's an opportunity to do that, and as I said before, it's essential to do that if we're going to sustain any agreement and have it accepted by the public. So ultimately, we have to fix the process. This is, I think, an excellent opportunity to do that, to rethink that. And there are people in the Congress, both parties, offering a number of ideas for reforming the congressional process right now. And so I'm somewhat optimistic.
Well, I just want to pick up on that and go a little bit on the prescribed changes that you lay out for the strategic budgeting approach. What would remain constant in the budget process? I assume the political nature of it would remain constant.
Well, it's always going to be a process that's constrained by resources over some period of time. The federal government is especially able to postpone tough decisions because it has a great credit rating relative to other countries, and I emphasize relative to other countries at the moment. And so it can borrow cheaply, perhaps more cheaply than it should be able to borrow given the current outlook long term. So the market's giving us a lot of rope. So that's one thing that removes a short-term constraint. But over the long term, obviously revenues have to roughly match spending. And if there's a huge accumulation of debt, then we remain very vulnerable to changes in conditions that could cause interest rates to rise and put us quickly in a difficult spot that we couldn't get out of. But apart from that, another enduring feature of the federal budget process is this annual review. Mm-hmm. That's now down to about 40% of spending. It ignores the tax side of the budget, a lot of big mandatory entitlement programs. We need to figure out a way to bring those back into a regular process so that when we set priorities, we're considering all of the pieces of the pie on both sides of the ledger. That we haven't done. And then we're always going to have, as I said, shared powers between the executive and legislature. We're always going to have Congress and the president fighting over control of the reins. That's always going to be true. And we're always going to have this disconnect between state decisions, because they're sovereign and have their own resources and revenues, federal decisions, without much coordination for the foreseeable future. And we're always going to have tough politics in this country.
Well, actually, I'd like to turn to other countries and what we can learn. You do a wonderful job in your piece for the book, Governing to Win, outlining lessons from other countries and some U.S. states that have reformed their budget process to make it more performance-focused and strategic. Would you highlight some of those key lessons that you've learned and posit in your piece from, say, the Netherlands, Canada, and some U.S. states?
Sure. We've been talking to people in other countries that have had comparable challenges. In the Netherlands, for example, in 2009 and 2010, they faced a need to cut back on their spending. And so they set a target of 20% in various policy areas, and they set up a performance review process. In each case, for each major policy area, they picked somebody who was not responsible for within the government for that particular policy to chair a process. They brought in outside experts. They looked at the evidence of what works and what's efficient and what's not so efficient. And then they made recommendations. And then immediately after that, they held an election, and the major party platforms adopted many of the recommendations of this internal review process as part of their own platform. So after the election, there was a consensus on many of the changes that needed to be made in order to achieve those savings. Now, we're not like the Netherlands in the way we make decisions, but that's a good example of a strategic approach. Canada has been working on this front for many years and through several governments, and they have developed a set of performance information. In fact, they have reorganized their programs, redefined their programs around objectives or goals or functions, and then appropriated at that level, at a higher level of aggregation, so that more decisions about how to use resources can be left to the people who execute the budget. So they've given the managers more flexibility at the same time, and they've organized their information to make clear what their priority setting is. And then they've also been able to hold people accountable for performance because the resources are there and flexible to achieve those goals. And on top of that, they've added a strategic review process. The mantra there is value for money. And in Canada, they're now using that to drive savings, budget savings, and help keep themselves on a sound fiscal path. So those are a couple of examples. In the States, there's a lot of experimentation with the use of, and development of the use of performance information. Some states are better than others in integrating that with their budget process. Virginia and Florida have been leaders in that respect. And Oregon, they've set strategic goals for the state social goals, and then they've developed a set of indicators. Again, they've used this through several governorships so that they take a more strategic approach to what they're trying to achieve in their budget process. And in Washington State, the Washington State Institute of Public Policy has developed a methodology for the legislature and others to use to compare the costs and benefits of alternative packages of policies to achieve a given goal. And they've used that very effectively in the criminal justice area, for example, and in other areas to say, here's an alternative to the current mix of programs and policies that would perhaps provide greater public safety with less expenditure of resources over time.
Steve, as a follow-up, to what extent does the federal government's experience with performance-informed budgeting resemble that of many states? And more specifically, would the parliamentary system be more accommodating to performance-informed budgeting as opposed to our federal system?
Actually, we've made a substantial effort over a period of time since the passage of the Government Performance and Results Act in 1993. So we have over 15 years of capacity building and experience in the agencies, in the federal agencies, and with the congressional decision-making in the use of performance information. So we've got a much richer set of information, a more effective way of using that information to assess individual programs and to look at alternatives than we ever had in the past across the whole government. So we've actually made a lot of progress in that respect, and there are many good people who are very clear about what they're trying to do, working to build on all of that through both the previous administration and the Obama administration, trying different approaches, experimenting, testing. And there have been a lot of evaluations done of federal programs, not all of them good or rigorous enough, but there's a lot of literature and research out there, evidence on which to base choices, much more than there had been a couple of decades ago or three decades ago. The parliamentary system can make quicker pivot to the left. They can lurch left by changing government, and then they can stick with it for a while by the nature of that system, and they don't have these messy fights between two branches of government that we have. So that's an advantage in the short run. But we have the kind of politics we have. We have the constitutional structure we have, and we have to make it work. And we have, over a long period of time, made it work. To deal with a lot of tough problems. I'm sure that we will make this work.
What are the practical steps required to move toward a more strategic way of budgeting? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. Brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. The IBM Center has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, who brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. The Center This Week is with Gail Fossler,
contributor to Governing to Win, enhancing national competitiveness through new policy and operating approaches. And here's her take on defining national competitiveness.
Well, national competitiveness is to my mind, the ability of a country to meet its performance commitments to its people, to be able to provide economic opportunities, economic growth, and to do so in a balanced way that gives everyone a good opportunity.
Gail Fossler identifies certain actions that can be taken as the most effective way to restore the country's competitiveness.
Well, most of those actions align with the problems, which is we actually ask those questions in two different sections, and then we see if indeed there is an alignment. But education is really a very top priority of the business community. And in a more recent survey, where we were asking about the presidential agenda, you know, looking forward into the election year, you know, usually education and energy policy wasn't particular to this competitiveness, particular set of competitiveness questions. But I was surprised that education and energy, which is usually very specific and it ranks fairly far down the list, these two policy issues ranked just under pro-growth economic policies and general budget and tax alignment. So these issues, I mean, the business community is very consistent in wanting pro-growth economic policies, wanting an educated workforce, wanting a resolution of the deficit issues. Actually, they're very singularly aligned behind tax reform. Mm-hmm. And then finally, regulatory reform. So the things the business community wants stacks up very cleanly against those things they think would make America competitive.
Gail Fossler explains why the U.S. cannot cost-compete its way to economic prosperity.
The competitive liabilities are some of the ones we've already talked about. The high cost of health care, one of the branches of economics, looks at transactions cost. What does it cost to essentially transact business in an economy versus what does it cost to transform the product and the service? So, you know, you ask about unit labor costs, about cost competitiveness and the like. Those would be transformation costs. Things like healthcare costs are transactions costs. Information is a transactions cost. Tax rates are transactions cost. So, you know, you want to reduce both of them within reason, but which do not sacrifice things like the quality of healthcare, the quality of education, and the like. And so there's always another platform out there. Take China. Mm-hmm. We are all aware, we see on television, Apple computers, huge manufacturing facilities. You could imagine that those facilities might be in Northern California. If one were to look at the technology content, the way they're organized, the ability to turn over applications within a matter of a few months. So, there's no way we're going to cost compete. Mm-hmm. With China, because they, in that vein, because they have got all the technology, all the organizational capability, not just in the foreign investment, but in domestic enterprises, some domestic enterprises as well. So our ability to kind of pull ourselves together and make these decisions around education, around healthcare, around the innovation, to reduce the barriers which have been in place for 30 years now that seem to be creating less new business development. There's a palpable decline in new job creation among small enterprises, which was always a strength in America. So those are now, I think, much more important than looking at these comparative unit labor cost measures.
Gail Fossler explains how confidence in U.S. leadership has slipped as compared to a few years ago.
Basically, the confidence in our ability to sustain our global leadership is tied to the confidence in our ability to identify and tackle the country's most important problems. So if I may refer to the survey that we just took for the Business Council in May, mm-hmm. it was interesting that although pro-growth policies and the budget were number one and number two, number three and new in the survey was the ability of a president to end the political deadlock and actually create a breakthrough in terms of getting resolution of some of these important issues. So I think that over the last several years, and I really, you know, extends back several years, that the inability to define what these issues are and then to come up, I mean, if we set aside some of the more, well, maybe energy is still controversial, but it seems as if, you know, there should be, we should be able to come to terms on a national energy policy. Mm-hmm. And yet, it keeps getting swept out of the way. It shouldn't be as emotional as taxes or entitlements, and yet we cannot seemingly come up with a national energy policy. So how are we going to deal with some of these tougher problems? And when business looks overseas and they see a country like China, which is very statist in many ways, in the ways in which it makes its decisions, and very dictatorial in the way that they implement those decisions, we see ourselves wasting time, as it were, in the face of a key competitor that is very aggressive about establishing their international economic power and position.
This has been The Center This Week with Gail Fossler, contributor to Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. More information on this and other Center resources is available at businessofgovernment.org. There you will find how the business of government is not business as usual. For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com.
How can the federal government's purchasing and supply chains be transformed? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores this question and much more with Raj Sharma, contributor to the new IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. Next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. My guest today is Steve Redburn, author of Creating a Strategic Approach to Budget Decisions and a contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. So, Steve, what are some of the practical steps required to move toward a more strategic way of budgeting? And more specifically, would you elaborate on the new opportunities offered by the GPRA Modernization Act of 2010?
Right. This act, which builds on the earlier GPRA that I mentioned, codifies a lot of the innovations that were put in place in the previous administration, such as creating performance improvement officers in each of the major agencies and a council, it's called the PIC, the Performance Improvement Council, of those officers. They have also put into law many of the requirements and streamlined some of them for developing strategic plans and for agency performance plans and for setting targets at the agency level. But beyond that, and this is the most innovative, I think, an interesting opportunity offered by the new act that was passed at the end of 2010, is it requires the executive branch to define a limited set of federal priority goals that cut across jurisdictions, such as the one I mentioned that's a fairly low-level goal of dealing with environmental conditions in coastal wetlands, but also for reducing and eliminating homelessness among veterans, for example, is another goal that the Obama administration set at the beginning, which fits this model, where you have multiple agencies and programs all aimed at achieving that goal, and you plan together strategically to find the best strategy and to drive improvement. The homelessness goal is a good one to look at because there's actual documented success there. There's a successful strategy that was identified in the previous administration and is being applied, which essentially is a housing first strategy that takes people off the street, out of emergency shelters, who are chronically homeless, and puts them in a private apartment, links them with services, and helps stabilize them, and in some cases get them back into the economic mainstream. Very strong base of evidence that shows that that's cost-effective, that it roughly costs the same amount for government to keep people on the street and using emergency services and so on, getting in trouble with the law, as it does to use this alternative, which is much better for them, and allows you to see the possibility of reducing and ending that kind of homelessness, which is a blight on our cities and our society and very inhumane. So we see progress. We've seen a double-digit drop in the number of homeless veterans in the last annual count. So there's evidence that that strategy is working. It's an example of setting a goal that cuts across programs and agencies and then driving improvement by using resources more effectively to achieve that. And that's an opportunity that is now presented by the new act. And the administration has, in its latest budget proposals, identified a number of other similar goals around which it's going to organize reviews and then propose strategies and drive improvement. So that's the opportunity. And that fits very nicely with the model of the portfolio budgeting approach that I mentioned earlier.
You point out in your piece that OMB is given a stronger mandate to develop an annual government-wide performance plan, and setting out the federal priority goals. Is that the high-performing goals, maybe? Designating a lead official who's responsible. How can such a plan, that kind of annual performance plan, be the foundation for strategic budgeting?
Well, it forces you to think explicitly about what are priorities. And since we have a very limited pool of resources going forward, and we're going to have to be in a prolonged period of budget austerity, we really do need to prioritize. The executive budget process has done that to some extent in the past, but it's never put down on paper across the whole budget very explicitly. These are the highest priority uses. These are our strategies. And under the old act, it was not required to do that as it interpreted it. So I think there's an opportunity here, and that by doing that in a very public way as the president presents his budget triggers a public debate, and we have the democratic process at work on those priorities, and Congress gets involved. And Congress really needs to be consulted as part of that priority-setting process, given the nature of our system. And they need to get more engaged than they have been in the past in all this approach, which I expect them to do.
Well, would you explain the benefits to those who lead the budget process in restructuring budget decisions around sort of enduring missions, long-term societal goals? What's the benefits of doing that?
Well, for any administration to succeed, they're going to have to use resources more strategically than they have in the past. It's a luxury that we can't afford any longer to keep putting money into spending programs that are less important, given our national purposes, or benefit only a narrow group, or just not efficient. I would look particularly at the tax expenditures, the more than $1 trillion worth of spending through the tax code in that regard, and at reforming the tax system as a whole to make it more efficient so that when we raise revenues actually go up and not just leak out through the holes in the bucket that are created by these special provisions. So that the advantage ultimately will be to put the economy back on track and increase its rate of performance.
So to actually realize the strategic approach to budgeting that you've outlined, I believe it requires its heavily emphasis is on analysis of costs and options and benefits. What institutions, maybe external to the government, could provide sort of technical and scientific assistance in doing this?
Okay. Well, I mentioned earlier that the states are pioneering some of this. I mentioned Washington State in particular. And the Pew Charitable Trusts are now replicating that with a group of other states. So that may become a general model at the state level that the federal government can look at. But within itself, the federal government has great analytical resources. The Congressional Budget Office is a product of the 1974 Budget Reform Act that is a marvelous institution that produces nonpartisan analysis of the highest quality, not just for Congress, but for the public and the Congressional Research Service. And within the executive branch, there are tremendous talents and analytical capacities in the agencies that should not be overlooked. But outside the government, Congress has chartered, back in the Lincoln administration, chartered the National Research Council or the National Academy of Sciences to advise on public policy questions based on the best scientific evidence. And that's what it does. It doesn't have a line in the budget. It's not a government agency. That's what it does. It does studies for the government and for the public that support this kind of analysis that we've been talking about. The National Academy of Public Administration, which has a similar charter, a much newer organization, can be helpful in looking at how policy is implemented and very practically what works and how to make it work. So those two institutions are good examples, I think, of institutions already set up and chartered by Congress for this purpose. Many volunteers, the best scientific minds are brought together, the most experienced governing people to work on those kinds of problems. They could be tapped systematically for this kind of strategic review process.
Well, I want to switch to shared goals, and you've done a wonderful job illustrating them in some of your responses. But what new procedures for systematic consultation between the federal and state governments could be pursued to this end?
We used to have an advisory commission on intergovernmental relations, which had the analytical task of looking across the levels of government. And that was abolished, eliminated years ago. So we don't really have a working model for the kind of analysis that needs to be done, nor do we have formal consultation structures, at least in the budget context, for working across levels of government. So we really need to create something brand new. And I don't have an immediate answer for you on what that would look like. It will always be a consultative, cooperative, communicative kind of body, because there's not going to be a formal combining of the budgets of the different levels of government. That's not in the cards constitutionally. But I mentioned the Recovery Act as a model for cooperation, and I think that kind of cooperation and communication should be fostered and would be very helpful so that the federal government and the states are not pulling in opposite directions, for example, when we're trying to stabilize and restore economic growth.
So to realize, again, the strategic approach to budget decision-making, to what extent does the Congress need to sort of revise or streamline its jurisdictional responsibilities? And would you elaborate on what that would look like if they were to do that?
Sure. Actually, later this summer, I expect the National Academy of Public Administration and the American Society of Public Administration will be releasing a series of memos on different aspects of public administration that will be made available to the campaigns and to the new congressional leadership for this electoral cycle. And part of that, which I'm working with others on, is addressed to exactly that set of questions we've been talking about. And in particular, we'll have recommendations for strengthening the congressional process. Mm-hmm. I think a key is strengthening the role of the budget committees as instruments of the leadership in the House and the Senate so that they can coordinate decisions, set priorities through that process so that the leadership can do that and be more strategic. So that's one key, is strengthening the budget committees. And then some people have suggested, and I think that ultimately this will have to happen, to streamline the work of the members of Congress who are just overloaded, to combine the authorizing and appropriations committees, so that you have the capacity to build expertise, to build staff and so on in a particular policy area centered on a particular set of missions or objectives of the government that are enduring and operate much more effectively than we do now. And that would also bring together all of these elements in each portfolio that are now scattered across different committee jurisdictions. So ultimately, and I realize this would be a big political lift, at any point. Ultimately, that's one suggestion. Alice Rivlin and others have suggested combining authorizing and appropriations committees, and I think that would potentially help.
So all of